Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. My name is Patty Scott. I'm the TIPQC Infant Quality Improvement Specialist, and I'm a nurse practitioner here in the Middle Tennessee area. I'm so excited to have Jesse Barnes and Mary Coughlin join us today to discuss trauma-informed care in the newborn intensive care unit. Just a little bit about each of our speakers. Mary Coughlin has a master's degree. She's also a neonatal nurse practitioner and a Caritas coach. I hope I'm saying that correctly. She is a pioneering voice in trauma-informed developmental care, whose science, soul, and skills approach in transforming NICU practice, leadership, and the future of care. She's also the founder of Caring Essentials and a global advocate for healing-centered systems. Jesse Barnes is an NICU nursing professional development specialist and NICU parent. She holds certifications in neonatal intensive care nursing, care of the extremely low birth weight infant, nursing professional development, and trauma-informed care. Her passion for equity-focused, trauma-informed, family-integrated care drives her professional practice. We are so honored to have you both join us today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's our pleasure. First, I'd like to hear a little bit about each of you and how you got involved in this work. Mary, can we start with you?
You bet. And just heads up, I'm not really good at making a long story short, but I'm going to definitely do my best. What's really interesting is how I kind of stumbled across this concept of trauma-informed care. Doesn't imply that it didn't exist before this discovery. And in fact, I often refer to it as one of the best kept secrets in behavioral health. But it was probably around, it was 2013, actually, when just kind of navigating different clinical experiences, I found myself as the interim nurse manager on an inpatient adolescent psych unit, which is a story in and of itself. But it was during that time where I got to work with some really amazing clinical nurse specialists in psychiatry, and I had absolutely no clinical experience. The hospital basically said, you're the only one here with pediatric experience, which is terrifying because I'm a NICU person. But I started working with the Department of Mental Health here in Massachusetts, and they were talking about this concept of trauma-informed care and did some really amazing coaching and education for me around the concept. And as they were explaining to me this phenomena of how early life experiences derail individuals' developmental trajectory, I started, of course, thinking with my NICU hat on and wondering, why the heck don't we know about this in the NICU? And so I just started reading about it, really diving in, uncovered some really good literature published by the American Academy of Pediatrics talking about this concept of toxic stress in early life, informed by a myriad of other disciplines, and just started writing about it. And that was it. I was off and running and preaching and teaching about the relevance of this topic within the newborn intensive care unit ever since.
I was just going to say, we would like to hear a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this important work.
Yeah, so my entry into this work was Mary Coughlin herself. I heard her speak when I was a relative baby NICU nurse, somewhere around the 2015-esque area. And I heard her speak and was like, oh, that's the missing link for the NICU. I felt, even as a newer nurse in this specialty, that there was something more than just being a really good IV starter or learning how to talk to a family. Like, there was something more than just that. And I heard her speak at a conference, a local conference, and I was like, that's it. Like, they're people and they're going to go on to be people. So we need to set them up for as much success from a relational standpoint so that they can navigate the world with a nervous system that is safe and prepared for all of the ups and downs that life is going to be. It's so much more than just getting home. It's getting them home as whole as possible.
I really love what you just said there, Jesse, because that was also one of the things that intrigued me about this concept of trauma-informed care, that in my initial experience, it was interacting with adolescents. And I was basically taught how to approach individuals who already had a history of trauma. So it was more of a responsive strategy. But when I started thinking about it within the context of the NICU, the paradigm of trauma-informed care actually felt like a prevention model, because we already had all this understanding now and research and evidence of the consequences of these lives impacted by early life adversity. And so in knowing that, and we're now interacting with individuals who are just beginning their life trajectory, we could use that knowledge to potentially mitigate and maybe even prevent some of the long-term adverse outcomes associated with early life adversity.
So I have a question. When I think about trauma-informed care in the NICU, I think about the arm that involves the baby, which is what you all were just referring to. But I also think about the arm that involves the mom and the dad and the siblings. Because I do believe there's some trauma, especially, I don't want to say just moms, but especially for moms, I think there is some trauma. I've had patients recently where mom has shared, we had a previous baby that was admitted to the NICU and people were lovely, but I still have bad dreams about this. So when you all talk about trauma-informed care, are you talking about both arms as well?
Well, truth be told, Patty, we're actually talking about the baby, the family, but also the clinicians that are in the space, because we're also bearing witness to this horrific life-altering tragedy that has befallen families, and it's part of the work that we do. So the concept really transcends all of the individuals that inhabit the space.
Sure. Thank you for saying that. I forgot about that. I forgot about the caregiver, and I should be remembering the caregiver, shouldn't I? Mary, as the president and founder of Caring Essentials Collaborative, can you tell us a little bit more about this collaborative?
So the name may sound lofty, kind of coming out of the gate and deciding that I wanted to really just dedicate the rest of my life to education around trauma-informed care. I envisioned really a global collaborative, and it really kind of evolved and taken on a shape of its own just through this natural process of the community that has enrolled in the program, who's really continues to champion this concept. So the collaborative is a very informal grassroots international body of passionate professionals that transcend all disciplines. The majority of them are in the NICU space, but there are many that kind of go across all of the pediatric and perinatal spaces as well. So it's really been an incredible experience and quite an honor to have seen this movement really evolve to such a global presence.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, we've talked a little bit about trauma-informed care in the NICU, but will you elaborate a little bit on that for us?
Yeah, so at the crux of trauma-informed care, no matter what your practice setting is, I mean, I'm very partial to the NICU, but it applies to anybody. It's really seeing someone for who they are, where they are, when they're there, right? Which sounds a little confusing, but let me break it down a little bit, right? So instead of asking the family, well, just be grateful, I saved your baby, right? And that's true. We did save their baby. In a lot of instances, families wouldn't be families without the professional skills that we bring to them, right? But that doesn't mean that it's not without harm to the parent. They didn't envision their baby being born under these circumstances. They didn't envision having to ask a stranger, no matter how nice we are, we're still strangers. They didn't envision having to ask a stranger, can I hold my baby? Am I allowed to feed my baby? What am I allowed to do? I mean, that is just a wild concept for a parent to think of. And then when they're there, they're also not in the best space. A lot of them, if they're a birthing parent, they're healing themselves physically. They're exhausted because they're trying to produce breast milk, if that's something that is their goal that they're trying to do. They're trying to take care of other children, maybe. They might have to go back to work. They don't have parental leave to be able to support them being able to stay with us, right? And so we keep saying, we need you here, we need you here. But it's like, we need you here, but only if you're going to present in this way. When really we need to be able to hold space for their full spectrum Now, I want to be clear in calling out early that that doesn't mean that we tolerate unsafe behavior, right? Sometimes when traumatized individuals are activated, they choose a more fight response, and then it becomes a safety concern. So that needs to be an individualized decision for each unit and each dyad and what's going on. But to Mary's earlier point, if we use it as a preventative strategy, we're much less likely to get to the point of escalation where now somebody is unsafe if we can start from a place of partnership and empathy from the very first minute or even before they come to the NICU during that, you know, prenatal consult or in the delivery room. We can go ahead and establish that they are the parents, they're an integral part of the care team, and we are all here to want what's best for their baby.
I like that. I like the way you worded that. I like that. Mary, you really are the pioneer who brought trauma-informed lens to the NICU. Can you explain to us what sparked that approach?
Well, yeah. I mean, to kind of like pivot off of how I got introduced to the paradigm, it really just became more and more apparent to me that these little people that we were caring for that were completely vulnerable, completely pre-verbal. We were making assumptions on what they were communicating. And oftentimes, in spite of existing research and evidence that may have spoken to the contrary. So recognizing the opportunity to make such a significant impact from a healing perspective. Like, I think most folks that are in the NICU, you've got a little bit of an adrenaline junkie in you, and we're glad that you're there. I'll be honest, that was the thing that drew me into that space. Besides my love for babies, was also my love for challenging, complex clinical situations, lots of calculations, you know, all that stim and fun. But what happened to me, at least, is I, for a while, lost sight of the human aspect of the work. I got so immersed in the tech and the doing. And so kind of recognizing the opportunity now to rejoin the tech adrenaline side of me to the soft, mushy, loving, compassionate side of who I am as a nurse is the thing that really sparked and continues to spark my passion and enthusiasm for this work. And also just kind of the growing and ever unfolding awareness of what this work means. Because initially, you know, again, I was focused on the baby and looking at all of the things, the disruption to their sleep cycles, the painful procedures that were often undermanaged, if even unmanaged, just the positioning and the flipping and stripping that I would do for the do-ups, 8-11-2-5, all of that mechanistic approach to the care that has to happen, but I wasn't really appreciating it happening in the context of a brand new human being's entire central nervous system being influenced and molded by these experiences and the emotions that the individual was having. So really seeing that piece, but then as you kind of alluded to earlier, you know, kind of bringing my head up and going, gee whiz, I think the family's probably freaking out too, you know, and really figuring out, well, what does that look like? And then of course, us ourselves as well, to now the point where realizing that the NICU is a microcosm of the world that we live in, that although this is our, as clinicians, our first interaction with this family, it's more than likely not this family's first experience with overwhelm, with trauma, and even just globally. I mean, the data pretty much states, you got a pulse, you've had some adversity in your life, and how these experiences aren't just one-offs, but oftentimes cumulative phenomena that can compound an individual's capacity to adapt and respond to situations in ways that are favorable, that can bring them through the experience and not have them drown in the experience, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. It makes a lot of sense. Now, Jesse, you are also a trauma-informed professional that's working in the NICU in Georgia. We've heard a little bit about how Mary inspired you, but can you tell us a little bit more about how her inspiration has informed your approach to this type of care?
Yeah, absolutely. So as my role as a clinical educator, I'm responsible for the nursing professional development activities, right? And so one of the big things I did when I first got to my unit was, okay, we could use some trauma-informed care support. And I think that's true of every unit. There is not a unit out there that could not benefit from this paradigm or even a revamping of a paradigm if you've done some initiative already. It's one of those things that you're never really fully done with. You have to continuously stay invested in learning, right? And so I worked with my labor and delivery counterpart, my labor and delivery educator friend, and was like, we should do something with all three areas of women's health, because the family intersects all three areas. They experience labor and delivery, they experience postpartum, and then in some cases, they experience the NICU. So we decided that we would make a class that couples trauma-informed care and implicit bias. And it's an 8-hour class that we talk about, and we do it with our new graduate and new to specialty nurses, because they're the people that we have the most control over schedules and things with. And we introduce this concept as a foundation to care, because that's really how I see it. I don't see it as an extra thing or an added benefit or this other thing. Like, I commonly will joke, like, you don't turn to the baby and go, and now's the trauma-informed care portion of your care, right? It just becomes integrated into how you navigate the healthcare system. And the cool thing about it is, once you get that brain like locked in, it's who you are, period, in the whole world. You don't stop when you clock in or out. You don't stop when you go home from the hospital. You take this to the bank. You take it to the grocery store. You take it to your kids. You take it to your kids' school. Everywhere you go, this paradigm follows you. And that's what gives me hope in all of this, because a lot of times when we talk about it, people will assume, oh, it's sad. We're here to talk about how everybody's suffering. It's just a sad, you know, existence that we live. And I just think that's short-selling the story. Really, it's recognizing that because we have this shared experience of adversity, we don't have to stay stuck in it. We can validate that we have resiliency, and we can build resiliency in other people. And we could take our experiences of surviving adversity and convert those to thriving despite the face of adversity, so that everybody can reach their full potential. But we have to see it in somebody before we can do anything about it. So recognition is the first stage, but by no means is it the last stage.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Miss Mary.
Well, good golly, Jesse. You lit me on fire with all of that information. And you really...
You ladies kind of feed off each other, don't you?
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, when you were saying, it's almost like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Oh, gee whiz, I'm really sorry. You had some sad stuff, so your life's going to be horrible, you know, kind of a thing. But when you start really understanding what this concept is, and the Academy talks about this, and other really wise people talk about this idea of being trauma-informed, isn't about summing up the suffering, but building the buffering, because adversity and traumatic situations are part of the human existence. And so, regardless of the setting, I love that you said that too, Jesse. I mean, people need to see this beyond the walls that we work in, because those opportunities and those spaces that we grace get to be spaces where we can build our competency, cultivate the skills of being more compassionate, being more understanding, being more forgiven, all of the things, being more respectful. So I just wanted to throw those 2 cents in there, pivoting off of you.
No, I think it's wonderful. I love how the two of you just kind of feed off each other. You just excite each other when you're talking about this. I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful.
When you've been mentored by somebody this long, it rubs off on you. And sometimes we just get going and you're like, okay, somebody's got to stop us.
Well, that's great. That's great. How would one of our physicians, nurses, or families learn more about this important topic?
Well, I would absolutely invite folks to come and visit the website, caringessentials.net. And we'll put that, share that with you for the show notes, and consider actually enrolling in the trauma-informed professional certificate program. I think that it's very much guided by the pedagogical principles of adult learning and reflective practice, and that sort of thing could be really helpful. We're happy to share any articles with you guys. Also, big advocates, both Jesse and I are on the executive council for the Family-Centered Care Task Force, which again dovetails beautifully with the paradigm of trauma-informed care. And of course, we'll come and talk to anybody. All right, you guys want a workshop? We're there in a heartbeat. So any way that works to support folks' ongoing learning, or maybe even just introduction to the concept, we're there for you.
So a question that I have. I've been in the NICU for a few years now, and families are changing. Their needs are changing. Their expectations are changing. And to Jesse's point, we want to be preventative in our care. We don't want things to escalate and them to be unhappy or disappointed or scared. And I think probably a lot of what we see when families are angry is fear. I do think it's fear. What can we do as professionals working in current day? What can we do to meet these needs and show them how much we truly do care and how we want to make this experience as good as we possibly can? I know it's not what any of us would choose. Nobody wants their baby to go to the NICU. Nobody wants their babies to be poked and prodded. I have cried a few times when people cry when their baby has to be admitted. It breaks my heart. This is not what they expected. But what can we do to meet the changing needs and expectations of our families?
I think one of the easiest things, and I say easy on the other side of a NICU parenting experience, right? I understand things are rarely actually easy, but is partnering with your families as early as you possibly can. Recognizing that this is a traumatic experience and we are going to hold space for the full spectrum of their emotions. Something I'll commonly speak about is this concept of toxic positivity. And that's where we tend to just say, I can't handle your negative emotions, so I'm just going to kindly ask you to not have them, right? And so when they are upset, we'll say things like, well, at least he's 34 weeks. He's only going to be here a couple of weeks. I mean, look at that mom over there. She's been here for 6 months. And we try to do this. And this grief is not a comparison act, right? We should never try to make somebody feel like their experience is all of a sudden better than someone else's. Because whether your baby's in the NICU for a year or for 2 hours, it's still not what you intended. It's still a traumatic experience. So really kind of partnering with them. And maybe on admission, it's something as simple as saying, hi, I'm Jessie. I'm going to be the nurse taking care of your baby today. What's your baby's name? Use the baby's name, right? And then say, I know this might not be how you thought that you would meet Aurelia. I'm really sorry that this is how it happened. I'm here to take the best care I can for you, and I'm going to keep you updated on what's going on. Do you have any questions right now? So it's really just acknowledging the congratulations on the birth, because that's important, but also that it wasn't what you intended. It's okay if you have mixed feelings about that. And either way, I'm going to be with you every step of the way. And then we have to live that action. And we have to have that culture change to say that I really will be here every step of the way, even when it gets a little rocky. Although I would argue if we're more preventative in nature, there will be less incidents of rocky situations.
I think because there's enough rockiness possibly with the baby's NICU physiologic status, right? Hopefully that would be the only rocky. And that's hard for parents. They don't understand what we understand, even though we try to educate. It's still, like you said, people do not dream about their baby going to the NICU. I'm sorry, Mary, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I apologize. Again, she lit me on fire. but I think also what Jessie did is she called out that while what you described, Jess, as these strategies and interventions are really, really important, there is a competency component to that, right? And that I think is not fully developed evenly across the board, right? There are some folks that rock it with the conversations and making the connections. But others, I've been in neonatal nursing for a long time. And when I first started, this is an awful thing to say, but I'm just being honest. We loved it when the parents weren't there. It was great because I didn't have that added burden. I didn't feel that way out of disrespect. I just knew that I didn't really have the skills. And so not having to be challenged with that made my shift a little bit easier. Now, of course, hindsight, I realized that that was really a disservice to me in my building my own skills, because it's not just the baby. You know, when you work in any pediatric environment, it's not just the patient. You are caring for a family in crisis. But how do we build that skill set in the clinicians, transdisciplinary, so that there is a sense of consistency, that compassion is pervasive across all of the interactions? Because those are the things that will help build trust. Just because you have a license and you've got 80 million initials after your name and, oh, you've got that snazzy stethoscope, doesn't mean you automatically deserve my trust. I'm terrified. I don't know you from Adam. I expect that you know the things that you need to know to take care of the disease processes that are unfolding. But that also doesn't mean that you're going to be my confidant, that I'm going to feel safe in your presence, because there are all these other phenomena. So I think this is an important point of discussion, that it unfolds over time, right? You have to build these skills. You have to identify what are the goals for the experience and then build the skills around that to deliver on that with consistency and reliability. Because right now it's pretty haphazard and it can actually compound the existing trauma that the family's already navigating.
I love that you brought up trust, Mary, because I feel it the strongest on transport. We go to a hospital to pick up a baby, to bring them to a higher level of care. The family doesn't know you. They don't know the physician that's going to be responsible for their baby's care at the receiving facility. They may not even know exactly where that receiving facility is. But here I am. My name's Patty. I'm the nurse practitioner. And I'm going to take your baby an hour and a half away from you. And I'm going to take really good care of your baby. And I know you don't know me from Jack the Ripper, but please trust me. I think it has always astounded me the trust we expect out of our families from the get-go. Do y'all have anything you want to add to that?
Do you mind if I pipe in real quick? So as we're kind of talking upon this paradigm or this concept of trauma-informed care, it's not this amorphous entity, you know, this energy or feel good. There are very solid pillars that help us work within a very consistent framework. And as you were speaking, you were making me think about the principles of a trauma-informed approach. Number one is safety. And it's not just physical safety. It's psychological, it's emotional, it's spiritual. It's all of the ways that we as human beings need to be present to feel safe. It's trust and transparency. And all of what you just mentioned right now. The next item across that is healthy relationships and interactions. And what you'll notice when you start thinking about these things is that they build on each other, right? The more healthy interactions I have with you, the more I begin to trust you because I feel safe. So there's safety, trust, healthy interactions. Then there's empowerment, voice, and choice. Not keeping me quiet or creating a space where I feel inferior because of the power dynamics, because those things are pretty invisible, but pretty ubiquitous, particularly in healthcare environments. So there's that empowerment, voice, and choice, and being mindful of the historical stories that may kind of painted that individual's position or perception of what the situation is. And that's all unfolding in a situation that is highly volatile, highly unsafe, super duper scary.
Yeah, I like to pivot the talk about trust because I work a lot with new graduate nurses and they're trying to learn how to do this. They understand that they should do it, but they don't know. And so then they have a rough situation with the parent and they're just like, well, they're just crazy. And you're like, okay, well, let's pack that in a little bit and let's talk about how we got here. A lot of the trust, like you mentioned, Patty, is just expected. I showed up, I have 85 letters, I've got all these fancy things, I've got 10, 15, 25 years of experience. So you should just trust me because I told you so, right? But no one is safe and no one trusts someone just because you told them that they're safe or that they should trust you. Trust has to be earned. Safety has to be felt in that person's body. And so sometimes it takes a long time. And for some families, you might never actually build it because of what their experience was prior to and might have even been in the OB office, had nothing to do with you. Right? Might have been growing up in a childhood in another state or another country, had nothing to do with you, NICU nurse practitioner, who's here to provide life-saving, compassionate care to this baby, right? So it's recognizing, when do I need to take my ego out of this? Because this has nothing to do with Jesse Barnes. This is what this family is going through. Now, I want to provide physical safety at base for everybody, but I'm not always going to be able to guarantee psychological safety, but I should try at every single opportunity. You'll catch more people that way, but you have to be okay with when it doesn't work because people are such a complex mix of their past experiences, ourselves included, that we can't guarantee that someone isn't going to be activated or we aren't going to be activated in the context of a clinical situation or family dynamic.
That makes really good sense. I'm sorry, Mary, go ahead.
What really helps me is reminding me that I also started out life as a baby. And so re-grounding myself in that shared humanity helps me use my own experiences as a touchstone to hopefully show up with a little bit more understanding, a little bit more compassion, a little bit more forgiveness for the families that are interacting with day to day.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's tough. It's tough, especially when you can tell that they're hurting. They're scared, they're hurting, and you can do whatever you can to try to explain things to them and make them feel safe psychologically and physically, or their baby feels safe. But it's a reach. It's a reach. I'm going to be here with you for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'm going to take your baby on the road. The expectation that they do trust is probably unrealistic, isn't it?
It really is. I do think one intervention that can be done, a lot of trauma and the lasting impact of trauma is around invalidation, being told that what you're experiencing is not real and your needs are ridiculous, the gaslighting kind of element of it. And sometimes the most healing thing you can say to somebody who's experiencing something that they identify as traumatic is, I see you. I hear you. This is hard. I wish that this wasn't happening. And sometimes in healthcare, I think especially we're afraid to say those words because we're afraid we're going to take accountability for something that we don't need to. And we're afraid of litigiousness and all that stuff. But this is about two humans having an interaction, not all the other systems at play. So those little moments of, I know this is hard for you. I'm so grateful that you were able to come and be with your baby today. And look at all of this breast milk that you were able to bring in. That's amazing. And it's those tiny moments of, I know this is hard. I know how hard you work for this, but I can show gratitude. And hopefully that can build those trusts after all, because sometimes you'll have a family just sit there and go, all right, I'm not crazy. This does suck. And you're like, yeah, it does. It's necessary, but it's also kind of terrible at the same time.
What I'm hearing from both of you, and correct me, but I'm hearing little moments of connection.
Absolutely. Couldn't have put it into a soundbite better myself.
Good.
Connecting on a lot of different things, right? Connecting mm-hmm. on the sadness or the distress, the stress, the trauma, but also mm-hmm. connecting on the joy. There mm-hmm. are moments of so much pride. I can remember moments of my own daughter's NICU experience where I was like, I was moved to tears, not because I was sad, but because I was so proud of her. Like mm-hmm. I was like, look at what we've done together. Mm-hmm. You know, so having a nurse walk in and be like, can you believe that she's still blah, 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 or she just started doing all this? Those moments of celebration were just as much connection as moments of validation around traumatic experiences as well.
And I love that you said that. What makes me think in the hospitals that I'm lucky enough to practice in, and I'm sure at lots of other beautiful places, the nurses make some of the cutest little bedside cards. Ooh, first bath. Ooh, first day off oxygen. And they put them in the beds for the parents. And they are very crafty and very creative. And the parents just love those. Or they'll take the baby's footprints and make little hearts for Valentine's Day. But that's connection, isn't it? Yeah.
It's those moments of normalizing what it's like to have a child. Because if they were at home, they would be taking pictures, they would have family, they would have a special outfit that they would use, or all these other things. And this is an abnormal environment. But we can try to carve out little slices of normalcy along the way. I still have Aurelia's name signs. I have her little feet and like all the things because they mean something to me. And it was nice to know that somebody took a second to say, I'm going to do something that isn't overtly medical for this family to show this is how this baby is being incorporated into your family. We had one nurse who would make she would take the tape measure for when we would do links, and she would send it home with me. She would cut it to her length and she would send it home with me so that my sons could see how big their sister had gotten, because we were still in COVID times and they couldn't come visit. But it was a tangible thing. They could be like, oh, she's bigger. And it was just something that she didn't have to do. But it was definitely this like moment of glimmer in all of the experience of the NICU of someone saw me as a mom in addition to just somebody who could make milk and you know, give consent for things.
Mm-hmm. And including your other children.
Yeah.
That's great.
You know, what you just highlighted too, though, with these beautiful stories is that's really living into the full spectrum of what it is to be a nurse, that the call for nursing is managing the human experience of disease. The disease is wicked seductive and sexy and challenging and all the things, but our calling is to manage the human experience of disease. And when we get to do both, it's like the best thing in the world, right? It's absolutely the best.
I agree with that. Are there other types of supports that families that might be listening today might consider utilizing for their child or for themselves?
I did want to give a shout out to a recent book that was published by a colleague of mine. She's a former NICU mom as well, and she's over in the UK. Her name is Gigi Conyigo Fernandez, and her book is called From Roller Coasters to Carousels. And what she did was she interviewed families, international families, about their NICU experience, and then kind of looked at themes around the family's experiences so that she could really kind of create this story that helped families understand that this is a shared experience. And in that, you can feel that sense of community and connection and not isolation, as often happens with families that are in crisis. So I think you might want to check out that read as a really valuable resource.
There are also a lot of parent-led organizations that are national that offer national support group sessions that are led by NICU parents for like a peer mentorship. I know Hand to Hold offers them, Love for Lily offers them. There's quite a few that you can find that will hold space for the full spectrum without getting too much into the medicalization of the support that they need, but really just there as someone who has lived that life and who can understand. Sometimes our non-birthing parents, like the NICU dad, Alex, he does so much great work with that for, you know, particular group of population of parents. So there's a lot of resources out there, and just kind of reach out and see. Family Center Care Task Force is a great place for parents to find recommendations for that.
Okay, that's wonderful. So as we're wrapping up, what should patients, parents, families that might be listening also want to know? What advice would you give them?
I want you to think about the superpower it is to bring somebody into the world and take care of yourself while you're taking care of your baby. It sounds like cliche because it is kind of for a reason, but find out what that means to you. If that means starting therapy so that someone can be a non-judgmental person to hold your space, if that means staying and sleeping at night, if it means staying at the hospital because you have a way to do that, whatever that looks like for you so that you can continue to show up for your baby, because being a parent doesn't end just because you go home without your baby. You are still going to constantly think that. So I just want to provide validation for anybody who's thinking, I should stay more, or I don't need to go as much. You do whatever feels right for you, because just as trauma is an individual experience, so is cultivating resiliency and healing.
As a grandmother of a former NICU person, my youngest daughter continues to carry the weight of her experience with her now. He'll be 3 years old in February. And so I think the thing that I've learned in watching my daughter navigate this is, again, that the story doesn't end at discharge. That ache, that wound can hang around for a while. And so really giving yourself the grace, acknowledging that your feelings are real, that yes, this was overwhelming. This hurt you deep to the core. And as Jesse said, do all of the things that you need to fully recover, to fully come back to the you that is now going to parent this little person in a new space with all of the potential wonders and joys and ups and downs that happen from being a parent. But I think to just ground yourself that this is a lifelong journey and you've got this, but just give yourself the grace and care that you need to heal.
Well, ladies, I think I could talk to you for another hour or two. This has been fascinating, and I hope our listeners are enjoying it as much as I have. I really appreciate you talking with us and sharing your time and your expertise with us. We look forward to talking to you some more, and we look forward to all your continued great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org. That's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.